Britain is such a class-ridden society that when you see an Etonian with ruddy cheeks and a ruling class accent, a lot of people look at that person and think, yeah, he should be prime minister. That's natural. And I think that Johnson plays on that with this kind of very exaggerated Bertie Wooster accent. You know, parodies it a bit as well, so you can't really attack him on it. But yeah, he's saying, I am a Toff. Toff men have historically ruled Britain. Vote for me.
Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, do you feel your time at Oxford prepared you for the cut and thrust of political podcasting?
Oh, yeah, sure, Jimmy, 100%. Clearly, there's like over 200 episodes of how prepared I was to deal with you. But I will say my experience at Oxford is quite different to what people most normally talk about, because I did a master's. And so my experience of Oxford is very much loads of Americans spending lots of money to get a quick master's degree rather than a lot of the, like, basically the Boris Johnson experience. But, you know, I had a nice time there. I joined the club. It was fine.
So that's what really counts. Obviously, going to Oxford is an essential part of joining the British establishment, so it's good that we can have Jazza on the podcast to represent that side of things.
Exactly, and I'm very happy to you, Jimmy.
Touching on that same theme, we're joined today by Simon Cooper, who is an author and journalist for the Financial Times, where he's covered sports, politics, cities, and much else besides. He's recently written a book called Chums, which examines the influence of Oxford University on British politics, and particularly a certain type of Tory who ended up championing Brexit and all of what's happened in recent years. Simon, thanks very much for joining us on the podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
So I'm going to start you off with an easy one, just to get us going. Is Oxford University responsible for Brexit?
No, but the genesis of Brexit is arguably at Oxford. You can almost date it. December 1990, the 19-year-old first-year historian Dan Hannan and a couple of mates, one of whom is Mark Reckless, the future UKIP MP, so outraged by John Major's plan to sign the Federalising Maastricht Treaty, they meet in probably the Queen's Lane Coffee House. It's not sure now what the venue was, on the High Street, and they found the Oxford Campaign for an Independent Britain, which 25 years on starts to look very much like the origins of the whole Brexit thing.
So you went to Oxford yourself, and I'm wondering how much of a personal anger you have in writing this, because, you know, the idea that Oxford has various nefarious effects on British politics is quite common. So what exactly was the impetus from your end of things?
I had a good time at Oxford as well, and I, you know, enjoyed it, got a lot out of it, made lifelong friends. But I think there is a nefarious aspect, which is the incredible focus on rhetoric, which is encouraged by the tutorial system and for future politicos like Boris Johnson by the Oxford Union. And the impetus really came, I was, you know, like everyone else, I was watching TV all night of June the 23rd up till dawn, watching, in my case, in horror, but it doesn't really matter whether you're for or against Brexit in this case. I just realized watching all these people traipse across the screen, Johnson and Cameron and Michael Gove, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Dominic Cummings, I thought, I know exactly where these people come from. I know where it started because I was at Oxford with them or just before them. And so I have a sense of the intellectual origins or the emotional origins of what we're now going through. And then these people, the Johnson lot, became the ruling caste.
When you talk about the intellectual origins of it, I sometimes struggle to identify that when looking from the outside in to them and those that are kind of like calling the shots at the moment. When you frame it with the limitations and the usage of stuff like the tutorial system and people being able to write essays, make arguments with very little information. Yeah. Is there anything that is kind of like ideological beyond like independent Britain that feeds into their choosing of kind of like Brexit? Or is it just like with Johnson, the suggestion that he chose to support Brexit in order to just for the sake of power?
I think with Johnson, that's probably the main reason. I think the emotional origins, probably a better word than the intellectual origins, the emotional origins for this cast, who are very important because they lead the charge for Brexit in alliance with Nigel Farage, who they don't really like. 17 million people vote for Brexit for all sorts of reasons. I'm really examining the people who led it, without whom it wouldn't have happened. So the emotional origins, I think, are Thatcher's bruised speech of September 1988. Thatcher had always been quite pro-European. She was building the single market with Jacques Delors, the European commissioner. And then she realizes, hang on, single market, great, but it's going to be accompanied by more political union. And she doesn't like that at all. And she has this epiphany that in her mind, Brussels is going to become this overreaching super state. So she gives this bruised speech, which is where she turns anti-European. It's 2 or 3 weeks before Jacob Rees-Mogg and I arrive at university. And for this bunch of people, it's a big, I would say a life-changing moment. It's a hang-on moment because they know at 18, they're going to run Britain one day. They're going to be Tory politicians. They know exactly where they're heading. And what they don't want is some Brussels bureaucrats trying to run the UK for them as they see it. And so this speaks very directly and personally to them. Most British people didn't really care whether Britain was run by an out-of-touch elite in Brussels or an out-of-touch elite in Westminster. But for them, this is us. This is our job, is to rule Britain. It's what our caste has done forever. So from September 88, this Euroscepticism grips these people. And so Jacob Rees-Mogg and Dan Hannan very early, you know, come together in the Oxford campaign for an independent Britain. Gove follows soon after. Cummings in his 20s joins the Business for Sterling movement against any plans to join the euro. So emotionally, Euroscepticism speaks to them. Johnson doesn't really care about anything in ideas or policies. He is the most cynical of the lot. But you're right, he jumps on in the end because he sees it as a chance to oust Cameron. They've known each other since early adolescence. And Johnson has always rather looked down on Cameron, whom he considers an entitled tough who didn't have to work for it in the way that Johnson sees himself as a poor middle-class striver who won all the glittering prizes at Eton and Oxford while Cameron just coasted along.
Poor man, I do empathise with him. You talked about the fact that they come out of school fully formed, basically. So they, at 18, you just said, know that they're going to run the country. That feels like a thing that holds back people from other backgrounds from actually going into the halls of power. Do we want, therefore, to have people from middle and working class backgrounds to be more like those that have these privileged backgrounds that then come out and go into university and think that they are that they're destined to run the country? Or do we want to take those that have that mindset down a few pegs?
I think that we need to reform Oxbridge. I mean, the public schools are a huge problem. And if I were Prime Minister, we would tackle them. But I think Oxbridge is, you know, it could be a great asset to Britain. You know, these are good universities with good staff, beautiful places. And, you know, I'm sort of an institutionalist more than Johnson. I believe in keeping the existing institutions strong, but I would make it Oxbridge for all. So I would not say we're here to take in 18-year-olds of whom still, you know, something like over 40% or so come from private schools. So they've been selected at age zero. And then we give them this kind of light education in mostly how to write and how to speak. And then we send them off into the establishment. So I would, you know, you were there as a graduate. Oxbridge is moving increasingly to graduate education, which I think is great. I mean, that tends to be sort of more serious, more academic than the undergraduate experience. But I would then use a lot for Oxbridge for all. So, you know, you're 48 years old, you didn't go to university, or you want to update what happened at university. You maybe came from a class where you were excluded from the whole educational process. You're bright and interested in something. We will bring you to Oxford or Cambridge for 3 months or for a year or whatever it is, and give you some of that excellent teaching. And so to spread that excellence across the whole population, I think would be a glorious goal and doable.
Towards the end of the book, and you touched on it then, you do look a little bit more at the Dutch and German university systems, which are less about funneling people into, you know, one or two institutions, Oxford and Cambridge, and more egalitarian in their attitude and their results. But do you think that there's a danger of undercutting Oxford as a leading university by adopting more of that approach? Because if you think of the 10 best universities in the world, Oxford and Cambridge are generally among those. And I think I'm right in saying that German and Dutch universities are not. So is there a bit of a trade-off here from your point of view?
No, I think that getting rid of undergraduate education could help Oxford and Cambridge concentrate much more on their mission of excellent research, which, as you say, they do really well, leading universities in the world for research. They make a lot of money out of corporate conferences. Well, great, that helps fund the whole thing, and American summer schools. But what do you do? Who do you want to teach? I think you should definitely be teaching PhD students, who are studying, bioengineering or ancient Indian history. That's great. But then instead of 18 to 21-year-olds who can really go elsewhere, we have a lot of universities in Britain. We have too many universities in Britain. Take in, as I say, the population as a whole, keep giving people refresher courses throughout their lives, adult education. How inspiring that would be to so many people if instead of a great tutor, and they're not all great, but a great tutor teaching you about political philosophy aged 18, maybe teach somebody who has been chosen for their intellectual excellence and not for their CV. At 35, that person might be more into it, more willing to, more appreciative of the incredible opportunity.
Like from my personal experience, like the experience I had as an undergrad from 18 to 21, and then the one where I came back in as like a relatively mature student in my late 20s, the attitude that you have to learning is night and day. And I wish I knew that kind of like going to university a little bit later was an option, actually, because it just wasn't, because you're conveyor belted in to tertiary education, in most countries, to be fair. I also love the idea of more accessibility of not just like people's backgrounds, but where they are in their lives. One of the problems and the critiques of the Oxford and the Cambridge system is that it creates these generalists. Do you think that we should stop educating people in this way? Are there other ways of being able to kind of like educate people as opposed to just making them write an essay every couple of weeks?
I mean, they work harder now. So the kind of very light skating over what you don't know education and then talking over the holes in your knowledge that somebody like Boris Johnson or I received 35 years ago, it's much more professional now. I think one problem with the British system, and you see that with this cabinet, is that the political side and the higher status degrees generally are the arts. So those are often the people who get big jobs in finance as well, which is weird. And certainly in politics and in the cultural elite, almost everyone has done art subjects. From the age of 16, very often these people, and I include myself in that, have done no science subjects, no maths even. And so you get this very thinly educated group of humanities students who can quote Chaucer, but when confronted with an epidemic, are not very good at, for example, assessing the statistical likelihood of different outcomes.
Are there significant upsides to a more generalist approach? Is being able to quote Chaucer useful, I guess, would be my question, beyond a pub quiz?
I think the idea of being taught how to think is very useful. I would have liked to have been taught how to think about subjects like statistics and economics, which I very much had to catch up on post university. And I've done my best to kind of give myself lifelong education because I realized at 22 as I graduated just how thinly educated I'd been. So I agree that university should be about teaching you how to think and not about imbibing lots of vocational knowledge that is probably going to be out of date in 5 years' time anyway. And sometimes Oxford does a good job of that. I think that I wouldn't say it's too generalist. I would say it's too narrow in the way that most people focus on the arts really from age 16.
Interesting way of putting it. I was wondering, because or the extent to which that this is really an issue about Oxford, or whether it is an issue about the ruling class. You've got this great phrase in the book, which is the great toff view of history, as opposed to the great man view of history. And I felt when I was reading the book that even though you were talking a lot about Oxford and you've referenced Jacob Rees-Mogg and Michael Gove and Boris Johnson arriving at slightly different times and the way they behaved at university, I'd almost have expected them to behave that way, irrespective of which university they went to. So how much of it is a problem purely to do with Oxford, and how much of a problem is it to do with the existence of a ruling caste, as you put it, in Britain?
I mean, it's both, but I think Oxford is a very important step on their path. I mean, there have been 15 prime ministers since the war. 11 went to Oxford. 3 didn't go to university. Gordon Brown, who went to Edinburgh, is the only prime minister since the war who went to a university other than Oxford. You can tell the whole story of British politics the last few decades without reference to any other university. So I think Oxford is an essential step in this. As for the ruling caste, I mean, one of the oddities that I realized when researching this is that from 1964 to 1994, I think, both parties were led throughout by state school pupils. If you think of, Thatcher, Wilson, Heath, Major, that was an era when it was felt by both parties, the British public won't tolerate people from the ancestral ruling caste anymore. Those people are history. And then Blair comes in, breaks the taboo, becoming Labour leader in 94, does brilliantly as a politician. And then the Tories feel, the Tories naturally have this kind of veneration of the Etonian because the Tories, you know, respect traditional British English hierarchies. And so when Blair does well as a public school boy, admittedly one who's, you know, whose father grew up with Glaswegian dock workers, they've made a very rapid rise. But Blair shows the Tories, look, you can restore the Etonians and still win. And that's what they do.
Clarify, Blair went to Fettes rather than Eton. And I don't think there's quite as much awareness of his background, actually, and how rich he is, and certainly in how he presented himself electorally. That wasn't part of his appeal, right?
Yeah, but Blair is also, he wasn't born into that class, the caste, in the way that Cameron was. And one thing about the British ruling caste is it's porous. It's open to entrance from below. And so, Blair's father, who, you know, was a working class man who rose, wanted his son to go there. But Oxford also takes people from state schools and says to them, we will equip you with ruling class manners. We will teach you to be comfortable when, you know, there's four knives and forks beside your plate. Be comfortable with people who went to Eton, be comfortable in posh medieval settings so that when you go to the Commons, you'll be fine. And so a lot of people like, say, Ted Heath or Harold Wilson, who came from very ordinary backgrounds and went to Oxford, they come out equipped to deal with the David Camerons or the Harold Macmillans of this world. That's also why Oxford's important. It says, we welcome you into the ruling caste if you weren't born into it.
Do you reckon the next ruling clan is going to come from these same institutions, from Oxford specifically? So if we looked at like the Oxford Union presidents and kind of like those who are jostling for power there, do you think they are going to continue to be those who end up going into these powerful positions? Or do you think that the funnel has changed at all, seeing as now we're seeing those in power at the top of politics, they were in university in the 80s. Have we shifted that yet? Is this a problem that we are fixing or have fixed already?
Well, one thing I do say is that Oxford and Cambridge in the last 5 years have made great strides towards becoming more open to state school people. Often the state school pupils they admit are from sort of leafy state schools, you know, to get the numbers up, but it's still the son or daughter of a doctor or a solicitor. But still, they're well over 60% now state school admissions, which is, I think, the most that's ever been measured. So movements in the last few years like Me Too and Black Lives Matter and the kind of general, also the anti-elitism of Brexit, have put pressure on the traditional institutions to be a little bit more open to everyone. So that's one way it is moving. And you could argue, you know, this is going to continue and Johnson and Cameron are relics of the past that's dead. But what I do know is that the tough class, the ruling caste, is trying to hang on in there. They don't want to be pushed out. So one of Jacob Rees-Mogg's nephews was recently president of the Oxford Conservative Association. And Eton, a few years ago, built a purpose-built debating chamber without microphones, so the boys would learn to project their voices in preparation for the common, where there are microphones, you don't have to project. But so Eton wants to produce the ruling caste. And if the rules for entry to the ruling caste change, Eton says, okay, we'll adapt to that. You know, we just want to hang on in there in power. So those people are not going to resign and go away.
Given that a lot of the people you name and criticise in this book are currently in government, Boris Johnson being the most obvious one, but you've also got Gove and Jacob Rees-Mogg in there as well, how hopeful are you that some of the problems you identify in this book will be addressed?
Well, they're not going to be addressed by this government. I mean, they don't believe that Britain has a problem. They don't believe that there's any kind of unfairness in access. They think we're meritocrats. You know, we went to a famous university, so we deserve to be here. And anyone whining about background is just a socialist, in their words. So they're not going to address it. But, you know, British institutions like Oxbridge or the BBC or the civil service are under pressure to try and find more people from other backgrounds at the top. Because, as you know, any list of who is at the top of Britain is just scandalous. It's very, very largely private schools in Oxbridge.
So you're hoping that a Labour government, say, would come in and would make some changes then?
Yeah. I mean, having said that, I mean, I do think Labour obviously is much more critical of this system. Having said that, Keir Starmer did his undergraduate at Leeds and then came to Oxford from 85 to 87 to do a law graduate course. So, and he was a leading light of the Oxford Labour Club. I discuss him in the book. So it's not just the Tories who get their ruling caste from Oxford. It's also Labour, but with Labour, you're less born to it. So I discuss somebody like Andrew Adonis, who grew up partly in Care, who then becomes a minister under Blair and Brown. Labour selects in a slightly different way. And also Labour always ignored, no, not always. In the period I'm talking about, Labour didn't do the Oxford Union. So what you see with somebody like Starmer is he didn't kind of learn to speak in that British kind of be the funny entertainer with the little riposte that people like Johnson and Gove did learn at the Oxford Union. And it's, in a sense, it's a political weakness for Starmer, because British people, for reasons I don't understand, like their prime minister to have that Oxford Union air about him.
What do you think's the appeal for that? Because it clearly works. The formula works. So something like 11 of the last of the prime ministers after the Second World War from Oxford, like that formula ends up working. Obviously, they have a whole institution backing them up and making sure that they are in the right places. But at the end of the day, people do have to vote for them. And people did vote for Johnson, knowing all of these things about him. They must have liked him, maybe not so much at the moment because of all of the fun he was having during lockdown. But they liked him at some point. So it must have some kind of appeal, right? What is it?
Well, look, I mean, all these Oxford prime ministers are not the same. So, you know, in terms of where they come from and how they entered the ruling caste, Margaret Thatcher and David Cameron and Ted Heath and Johnson, all they had different routes in. Oxford was essential to all of them, probably least of all to Cameron, who was fully made at Eton, was born into the ruling caste. What people, I think, see, not what a lot of people see in Cameron and Johnson, I think, is the idea of born to rule. So Britain is such a class-ridden society that when you see an Etonian with ruddy cheeks and a ruling class accent, and with Cameron also the height, a lot of people look at that person and think, yeah, he should be prime minister. That's natural, because that's the way Britain has always worked. So there's a template for the Cameron figure as prime minister. And I think that Johnson plays on that with this kind of very exaggerated Bertie Wooster accent. You know, he parodies it a bit as well, so you can't really attack him on it. But yeah, he's saying, I am a Toff. Toff men have historically ruled Britain. Vote for me. And that is surprisingly persuasive. I mean, even in the Tory party, you'd think there's a lot of people in the Tory party who want to be prime minister, but they naturally cluster around Johnson because it sort of felt right among Tories that the most charismatic extant Etonian should be the PM.
You keep using the phrase throughout the book, ruling caste, which I think is appropriate, and I totally recognise what you're describing, but the main mode of the way we talk about our society is meritocracy, and that's something that politicians will bang on about incessantly. So do you think that most people would accept that we have a ruling class, and do you think they would describe it in that way and see it in that way?
I mean, I use the phrase ruling caste because there's something about being born into it. Ruling class suggests more a kind of economic class. I think it's a bit different because having money and being a member of the boarding school caste is not exactly the same. So David Beckham has a lot of money, but he's not a member of the ruling caste. So
what an interesting world that would be, though.
Well, I mean, a lot of people who become rich in Britain then send their children to boarding schools so that the children then enter the ruling caste. And look, this caste, this kind of Eton and Oxford Tory caste, is a perennial in British history, but they don't always rule. So they weren't ruling, let's say, in the Blair years or in the 60s and 70s. Now I've forgotten your question.
My question was, do you think most people would accept that we do have a ruling caste, or do you think it's a more, do you think we have more an American attitude where, you know, we're a nation of temporarily embarrassed millionaires, or some phrase like that?
Do people think it's a meritocracy? I think Boris Johnson is such an exemplar of somebody who entered this caste age about 7 or 11, and who is, I think he's a bright man, but he stopped working and thinking hard when he was about 15. And he realized that his quality was charisma and charm. And so he actually works very hard on self-advancement, but he's not the person who sits, you know, late at night reading the dossier. So he is an example of somebody who uses these class attributes, including accent, rather than work. So I think people are aware now that our meritocracy is not what it's cracked up to be. And also that Oxford, I mean, that's what I try and show in the book, Oxford is not really much of a meritocracy. When Rees-Mogg went in the 80s, it was about half private school. And there were only about 3 applicants per place. And in a subject like classics, I think there were 2/3 of the people who applied got in. If you came from the right caste, it really wasn't that difficult to get in. And once you got in, you didn't have to do much work. So Oxford, for people who don't know it, often has this kind of sheen of merit that is not always deserved. Sometimes it is, but not always.
Yeah, dear listener, I managed to get in, so it ain't that good. Thank you so much, Simon, for your time. The book is called Chums and is available at all good book retailers, I suppose.
Yes.
Can you give us, I like to ask at the end of any chats we're having, what is like your kernel of hope? Because we need it.
My kernel of hope is that people are really fed up with the system that has produced these people as the ruling caste. It doesn't seem to me or to most people that they are kind of the most brilliant, hardworking, talented, socially committed people in the country. So I think there's a strong feeling, and you see it with movements like Black Lives Matter and Me Too, and even with Brexit, there's a strong feeling it's time to overturn the existing order.
Ooh, I liked that.
That's a very strong message to end this podcast on. Thanks very much, Simon.
Thanks, both of you.